Tonight on Arena, in Look, It's a Woman Writer, 21 Irish writers tell their own writing stories. And new albums from Laura Mvula, Bobby Gillespie and Jenny Beth, and Brendan Tallon up for review. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Playwright John Millington Synge was no stranger to controversy, his Playboy of the Western World having caused riots at the Abbey Theatre in its day. But an earlier work, In the Shadow of the Glen, also caused upset among Irish nationalists, Arthur Griffith calling it a slur on Irish womanhood, as it told the story of a woman who leaves her husband for another man. Well, to celebrate its 30th anniversary, Blue Raincoat, the Sligo-based theatre company, has just produced an online version of Synge's In the Shadow of the Glen. And Christopher Morris has watched it for us and he joins me now. 30 years, quite a landmark for any theatre company, particularly for Blue Raincoat, I suppose, in this case, Christopher. It's a very volatile landscape, the theatrical world. But this is a company who, I think, have been innovative from the very start.
I think that's right, Sean. I mean, it sort of crept up on us as 30th anniversary. You know, I would have said, oh, they're a relatively recent company, and you realize they've been at it for three decades. I mean, this is you know, if you want a success story of a regional theatre company, they've been making theatre in Sligo in the factory space there since 1991. And, you know, they don't just produce plays, and they have quite a steady output. It's kind of 4 to 6 a year. But they're also running workshops. They're doing things in the community. They're doing teaching. I mean, it is a classic example of what happens when you can actually have a kind of company with a space and with a certain amount of stability and, you know, just let them make theatre.
And it's not that they're doing, you know, very traditional fare in a very traditional sense. They really are an experimental theatre company pushing the boundaries all the time.
They do things in an interesting way. I mean, they are pushing the boundaries and they've done some really, you know, innovative work, and they've done interesting adaptations of work by people like, you know, Flann O'Brien. It was something by Ionesco. Like, you know, one of the plays, you know, they have in, I think they're in their repertory is Rhinoceros, which is a mad play. And then they'll do plays from the traditional Irish canon that we don't really see. So they've been doing Yeats plays, for instance. You know, they have a production of Ambolia Strand coming up later this summer, and they do a play like the one we're looking at this evening, In the Shadow of the Glen.
Well, give us a sense of what In the Shadow of the Glen is dealing with here. It's set in County Wicklow. A young woman lives with her older husband, but it's a very stark household that we're brought into.
Yeah, it's a really atmospheric piece. And I think this is one of the things this production captures so well, is this sense of atmosphere. You have a woman, Nora Burke, who's played here by Sandra O'Malley, one of the Blue Raincoat company, who lives with her husband, Dan Burke, played here by Kieran McCauley. And they live in this very, very remote cottage, farming sheep way up in the Wicklow Hills. And when the play opens, Dan appears to be dead. And a tramp arrives. And the tramp's here played by John Carty, who will be familiar, I think, to a lot of people. I mean, he's a presence in a lot of things. And she goes off, Nora goes off to tell the nearest neighbor, a man named Michael Dara, played here by Bob Kelly, that her husband's died. And so the tramp's left alone with the corpse, who reveals himself not to be a corpse. He kind of pops up and says, I'm not actually dead. I'm just pretending to be dead so I can catch out my wife. And so the tramp, okay, sort of, you know, is surprised and then, you know, agrees to kind of let him pretend to be dead again. And then they come back in with the neighbor. And of course, the neighbor immediately thinks, okay, Nora's widowed now. She has a nice bit of land. And he's kind of trying to make a move. And then Dan reveals himself to be dead, not to be dead a second time, because a second resurrection, one more than our Lord. And just sort of pops up, you know, and basically, you know, threatens everybody, abuses everybody around him.
And I suppose the heart of the abuse that the Dan Burke character is throwing out is around this Michael Darragh, the neighbour character who's coming in, played by Bob Kelly, and who's basically saying, well, look, I'm available, Nora, if you're available now, so let's run off together.
Yes, there is that. But a lot of it is, I mean, one of the things that struck me watching this play is just how brutally misogynistic the character of Dan Burke is. And there's a kind of bit of business that I didn't really remember from it, but where the first time he has a resurrection from the dead, he gets the tramp to bring him this kind of black stick he has in the corner. And it's quite clear he's going to beat his wife with it, and that he has done in the past. And you think, God, this is a really awful character. It's about the closest, I was trying to think through Singh's works. It's about the closest Singh comes anywhere to creating a monster, I think, in his works. There's very little sympathy for Dan Burke. And his ire's really directed at Nora. You get to the end of the play and she just decides she's going to leave with the tramp. And that's how it ends. Yeah, she walks off with the tramp.
You say very little sympathy for Dan Burke. Unless, of course, you're Arthur Griffiths or the whole bundle of people who protested at the play. This idea that a woman, because she does go off with the tramp, as you say at the end, sorry for that spoiler alert for people who don't know the half hour of the play. But, you know, that was a major source of controversy. The thought that a married woman could take it upon herself to leave her husband. Huge controversy at the time.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, you know, you start to look at it now and you think really what the controversy was about was it was showing some members of the audience, I think, their own misogyny, and they didn't like it. You know, it looks like a very different play now. But it holds up because you realize the core of the play is the character of Nora Burke, and it's just her strength that is the real core of the play.
It's her strength as a character, and also the sympathy that we have for her, not least because of the words that Singh puts into her mouth to help her describe her situation. Let's listen to a clip which features Sandra O'Malley, as you mentioned, in this Blue Raincoat production of In the Shadow of the Glen, playing the character of Nora Burke, and she's speaking to the tramp here about how life is for her in this glen.
I'd have been thinking in the long nights it was a big fool I was back then, Michael Durr. For what good is a bit of a farm with cows on it and sheep on the back hills when you do be sitting looking out from a door the like of that door and seeing nothing but the mists rolling down the bog and the mists again and they're rolling up the bog and hearing nothing but the winds crying out and the bits of broken trees were left from the great storm and the streams roaring with the rain.
There you go, Sandra O'Malley is Nora Burke. Actually, it's Michael Dara that she's speaking to there, not the tramp. It's the young neighbour that she's speaking to in that particular clip. But the language, there's such romance in the midst of all of the bleakness in some ways, isn't there?
Yeah, and you know, I mean, what Niall Henry, who's director here, does so wonderfully is he just strips this production right down and he slows it down. And you hear that language, and you know, and I don't know if it's at the moment, everything seems like a piece of COVID art. But you know, you think of all the people over the last year and a half who have talked about wasted months and wasted year, and here's a character who just articulates this sense of having wasted part of her life, of wasted time, in the most powerful way. I mean, that great image of the kind of mist rolling down the hill and the mist going back up the hill again. And she's basically asking herself, is this my life?
Well, Nora's in permanent lockdown. She's not dealing with a number of weeks and one killer. She is in permanent lockdown. She can barely step foot outside the glen, I would have thought, without the permission of her husband, is the way it would have been at that time. What kind of the production that we get here, explain the setting, first of all, that we're given.
Yeah, it's a very interesting setting because, as I say, it's a very stripped down production. So while the play is quite clearly set inside, there are kind of leaves scattered all over the stage. And you have the sort of intimations almost of trees and things around you. So you almost have a sense that this is happening outside.
Yeah.
I think, you know, again, we're in this kind of strange moment where inside and outside are you know, kind of fluid, you know, about, you know, whether we dine inside or dine outside. Yeah. And it's this strange sense, almost like a kind of, it's almost like a kind of rest.
A kind of which? Say that again,
Chris? It does something, it's almost like a kind of ritual taking place in the forest here. You know, just the way it's so slowed down and it's taking, and what Peter Martin, who films it, what he does is he kind of moves the camera around quite a bit. So it allows the characters to stay quite still. So you have this incredible sense of stillness. And I think, again, for coming out of a year where we all know what it is to be stuck in one place, it really, really powerfully captures that.
And it's also a piece that, for all that stillness that is there, we know at the point at which we know that the corpse has jumped up once, you know he's going to jump up another time. So there's this constant tension in the piece as well. How do Blue Raincoat manage in achieving that?
I think, I mean, they work quite very well with that, and you know, the Dan Burke character is kind of there center stage all the time. You're always aware of him. He's there with this kind of big white sheet over him. I think what they don't do, I mean, you can play that moment for a laugh. I mean, the moment when the corpse jumps out of the sheet and the tramp is there on his own can be funny. They don't play it that way. And what I think that allows to happen here is to kind of build the atmosphere without that kind of comic interlude, so that when you get to the speech that we just heard and you get to that passage of the play where suddenly what Nora glimpses is this kind of complete wastage of her life, and the need to turn that around, that moment becomes more powerful.
And performances then, you've mentioned Sandra O'Malley, John Carty, Kieran McCauley and Bob Kelly in the four parts. Anybody stand out for you?
Well, I mean, it's Blue Raincoat are such an ensemble. I mean, they're so used to playing with one another that they just interact really seamlessly with one another. The one actor that really just did stand out for me was just John Carty. He's just such a presence. I mean, the tramp actually has very little to say or do in lots of ways. And yet he has to be convincing enough that you believe Nora Burke is going to leave with him at the end. And John Carty manages to do a lot of that just simply by sheer presence. And I mean, that for me really stood out. But look, there are four really great performances in this.
Right. So it's well worth seeing, I think, is what you're saying to us, Chris.
Absolutely. I mean, it is not a waste of half an hour. You will not feel that you've been watching going up and down the glen when you watch this for half an hour. It is well worth watching for half an hour. Yeah, really good production.
And it's amazing what you can pack in. Amazing what you can pack into a half an hour if you're John Millington Singh, and if you have a director then like Niall Henney realising it for you with a cast, as we've just mentioned. Chris, thanks for speaking with us this evening. That's Christopher Morash, and Blue Raincoats in the Shadow of the Glen by J.M. Singh is available online on Sunday night, July the 4th, as part of the Cardiff Sligo Arts Festival, and you can find out full information on cardiffestival.com. The anthology Look, It's a Woman Writer recalls what life was like for poets, playwrights and fiction writers who happened to be women in the Ireland of the 1970s, 80s and 90s, edited by Eilish Ní Chuimhne. It's a collection of 21 essays from contributors including Mary O'Malley, Leah Mills and Evelyn Conlon. It provides a fascinating snapshot of a time when a poet could still be told that going to hospital with a sick child was not a suitable subject for poetry. The subtitle of the book is Irish Literary Feminism, 1970 to 2020. Delighted to be joined this evening by editor Eilish Ní Chuimhne and poet Moya Cannon, who is one of the contributors to the book as well. The idea for this, first of all, Eilish, came around a very important cultural event, I suppose, or moment in terms of theatre at any rate, the Waking the Feminist movements that sprang up around the time of the announcement of the 2016 Abbey Theatre programme and the absence or a practical paucity, certainly, of female playwrights represented in that programme that was announced at the time. How quickly did you think you were going to do something in what you've done in this book?
Well, that was one of the inspirations for the book, yeah. And it wasn't a paucity of women playwrights. I mean, celebrating 1916, which I guess represents freedom and independence and equality, the Abbey quite amazingly selected 18 plays by men and one monologue for children by a woman. It gave rise quite understandably to the Waking the Feminist movement, which was a protest against that. And that has borne some fruit, I think. But I guess for writers of my generation, it kind of seemed like there was deja vu, you know, because we thought, yeah, we were making these protests like 20 or 30 years ago, and here you are, and the same thing is still happening in the theatre world. But that was one of the inspirations. Mm. But the other inspiration was around the same time I was reading a memoir by David Lodge, the writer I like very much, called Quite a Good Time to Be Born, and that's 1935, the year of his birth in London, and doesn't sound like a great year, but for obvious reasons, but in fact, because, you know, post-war, free education, the NHS, publishers are open to writers, all that sort of thing meant, yeah, it was a good year to be born. And I thought, yeah, and the year I was born, 1954, was quite a good year to be born if you were a girl with, you know, a pen in your cradle, as I put it in the book. Because even though it was a terrible time in Ireland, we don't have to go into the 1950s in great detail. We hear about them all the time. But, you know, books were banned. There was no talk of gender equality, as far as I know. But by the time people like me were going to school, there was free education came in 1966, not free university education, but grants for children. I wouldn't have gone to university if John O'Malley hadn't introduced the grants in the late 1960s. All those kind of things. And then along came the pill, and it took a while to get to Ireland, obviously, and feminism and the EU, and the whole scene changed for women in general and for writers as well.
Yeah, and certainly that's what you're celebrating, I think, in the book. In the case of these 21 writers,
it was a positive time. It was, you know, there is a tide in the affairs of men and women, as a male writer put it, and we who were born in the mid 1950s caught that tide, you know. Yeah.
Maya, when Eilish approached you then, and I think this is more or less how she approached all of the writers involved, what was the brief that was put out to you in terms of what you might do or write for this new anthology or new collection?
I think when Eilish approached me, she said that she was sort of interested in people's pathway into writing and publishing. And I sort of thought about it for a while, and then I thought that's quite an interesting theme, really. Because I do agree with her. I was born in 56. I do agree with her that we were a very, very fortunate generation. And so it was quite kind of interesting to think about that. And it's fascinating to read the essays in the anthology. They're just so varied. I mean, people's experiences vary enormously from the youngest to the eldest. And I think we were very lucky for many reasons, but one of the main ones is that we had these older sisters who cleared the way for us. Mary Dorsey talks about, you know, moving into the space cleared by our mothers. And I think that's terribly true. It's very interesting reading the books, how that generation of women who were confined to their homes because they had children to care for, no contraception, so one pregnancy after another, they got married and were pregnant for 10 or 15 years. But as Martina Devlin says, you know, in general, they urge their daughters onwards. And it's very interesting to see how many of the writers do speak about the encouragement of their mothers. Mary O'Donnell talks about her mother giving her Edna O'Brien's The Country Girls at the age of 12 and introducing her to Patrick Kavanagh's work. And Maeve McGuckin also speaks of her mother's deep interest in literature. And but we had older sisters as well. And those were the poets that went before us, just this generation, half a generation ahead of us, Eileen Uchéilín, Van Bolen, Nuala Nyugonal, who really fought the good fight. And
I think in some ways, though, Maya, you might have been unusual. Now, everybody's story is different, obviously. But your mother had studied at Queen's, in fact, hadn't she? And had studied English literature, I think, was one of her major subjects. Also, there was another poet in your family, Roisin Ní Chaoil.
That's right. My father was a woman poet. He did marry twice and have six children, so it was quite an achievement to be a woman poet. And he wrote under an Irish nom de plume. He wrote a little poetry, and he called himself Roisin Ní Chaoil. There was a singer called Roisin Ní Chaoil, but I think it was a play on the local place name. And he corresponded with Seán Ó Riordan, actually. And I think Seán Ó Riordan said he'd like the poetry and he'd like to meet the poetess at the time. So I think the nom de plume had to be dropped at that point. It never occurred to me that a woman couldn't write poetry, to be fair. My mother was also very friendly with Alice Milligan when my mother was a young woman and Alice was elderly. But I mean, at the same time, it never occurred to me to write poetry until I was 22. I couldn't imagine how anybody, how it happened. You know?
Yeah. Well, we'll come back to how what the specifics of what happened to you were. But yeah. Eilish, you were already told that a woman can't be a good writer by a boyfriend. I presume became an ex-boyfriend fairly quickly after that. But
he was a nice boyfriend. But and this was when I was, you know, I am going to be a writer. So I had no reservations, and I was completely blind to, you know, the gender aspect of writing when I was a teenager and a student in University College Dublin. I didn't notice that we were reading mainly, almost exclusively, works by men. It didn't put me off in the least, and neither, I have to say, did the comment of my boyfriend. But I... But I kind of, as I think I write in the essay there, I did think, yeah, I know what he means. He means that we can't write about sex. And in the same kind of open way that men could.
Yeah. You're breaking up slightly there, Eilish. Unfortunately, the line is breaking up. So we'll see if I can get that a little bit better. And I'll come back to you, Moya, then. On your own, you mentioned this idea that there's a word actually you use in the very first, and I thought, yes, of course a poet is going to make a great use of a word even when she's writing in prose. It's the word expression, but in the opening sentence of your essay, I came to write poetry in my early 20s as a means of literally of expression, but it's ex-pression. Just explain what you mean by that use of the word expression.
Oh, well, they're an awful lot of a young person between about 16 and 22, you know, is subject to a great deal of internal pressure. You know, they remind me of a sort of a butterfly or a moth inside a pupa trying to get out. They don't know quite what they are, and they're just trying to come together, and there's huge confusion. And huge pressures from society, from your own desires, from your own needs, from your own feelings, from your own thoughts, and just trying to make sense of all of that. In fact, it was I sort of came across a rather nice thing in Mary Dorsey's essay where she said, you know, just saying her impulse to write, she said, I experience it as a need to make sense of existence through words and imagery. And there's a tremendous release in that, you know, when you put that pressure outside yourself and put it into an image, into rhythm. There's great release in it, I find. Like the release somebody gets when they sing a song or paint, etc.
Yeah. I just love the way you hyphenated the word. It just gave it something extra for me reading it on the page. And we have Eilish there on a different telephone line, so hopefully this will be a little bit easier for us. Celia Dufresne is another poet who features in the anthology, and she was told, the quote that I gave in the introduction, Eilish, she was told that neither Anne Lovett nor taking a sick child to hospital were suitable subjects for poetry, but she was writing Osgaelic as well. Celia was using Irish for part of her expressions.
Celia, yes, Celia writes that in her essay, which is, all the essays are great, but Celia's, I love its opening. There was nothing in my childhood that suggested I would be a writer. But anyway, she went on to write, and ironically, although she was told this by an editor and I think an adjudicator of one of the poetry competitions in the Erasmus, that these subjects were not suitable for poetry, Celia's big breakthrough came with her collection Fiacca Fulla, which is about the hepatitis C case.
Yeah.
And in fact, it seemed that all that material became very suitable for poetry as time went on. And I guess that is one of the aspects of you know, being a woman writer, to use that term, which some of the writers in the anthology don't like at all, but that the kind of subjects that women sometimes write about were in, you know, when we started off publishing, could be regarded as you know, too domestic, not exciting enough, not dramatic enough to be suitable subjects for literature. But, you know, but Virginia Woolf was already saying that, like, a battleground is more interesting than a shop.
Yeah, of course. There's another thing, that, something I wanted to pick up on, not in your own essay, Eilish, but in fact in your introduction to the collection. And you're talking, you know, people who heard you earlier did hear you say 1954 was a good year to be born. And I'm sure many people thought, what? 1950s Ireland was a good year for a writer to be born? When we think of censorship in particular, there's a quote where you have about, you know, several books that were banned at the time. And anything, and this is a quote, the book, several books that were banned, and anything that, quote, advocates the unnatural prevention of conception, advocates contraception, close quote. Where does that quote come from? Is that actually from the censor himself?
Yeah, that's from the censor. So as far as I remember, that's where that's from. So the books that were banned in the 1950s, and, you know, it went on into the 60s with infamously Edna O'Brien's The Country Girls in 1960 being banned, were mainly novels in English, and yeah, anything that had any bit of, you know, sex was banned basically in Ireland. You know, don't be making love on the grounds of Orson O'Cron, Paul Turk writes in a poem somewhere. You know, sometimes I think who could believe what it was like really back then, that, you know, coming out as a hetero, you almost had to come out as a heterosexual, let alone as an LGBT person or anything like that in those days. That there was such a puritanical attitude to the whole thing in the 1950s. But again, that kind of changed. My theory is that it's contraception and the pill really that brings about such an enormous number of changes for women, and then including for women writers. You know, lives change, but the literary scene changes too as a result of that. And, you know, we've made such a journey from 1960 when Edna O'Brien's The Country Girls was banned and burned and she was pilloried to Sally Rooney, Normal People. I mean, those two books are not dissimilar. They're building romance about girls finding their identity and their sexuality. One is received in that terrible way, and now the new one, Sally Rooney's, is received with accolades, and people are buying the T-shirt and the shorts, and you know,
although we shouldn't forget, you know, the great controversy that was around the portrayal of the sexual lives of the young characters involved in the television series. People nearly lost their lives on it. Because I was going to finish up by asking Maya then, obviously this is a celebration, and the stories that are told and the publishing houses that are mentioned along the way in terms of opening up the world of writing to female writers are hugely important. How far on are we, would you say, Maya, then? Eilish obviously saying, yes, things have improved, but have we still got a long way to go?
We still have a long way to go, I think, Sean. We owe an enormous amount to those publishing houses, Beaver Row Press, Summer Palace Press, Arlen House and Salmon Press in particular. So many of the writers here mention Jessie Len Denny.
Of Salmon.
Salmon Press. I mean, they created a slipstream into publication. There still is a problem with anthologies, a huge problem. Sometimes when I'm teaching a summer course for American students, you have to recommend two anthologies. It's like the church, you know, sort of women on one side, men on the other, because I have to take points from Peggy O'Brien's Irish women poets. You know, it's really embarrassing because there's so few women poets. They're fantastic women poets like Terry Hardy, Ava Burke, that just don't appear in the anthologies at all.
Yeah, and they should all be in poetry.
Way to go.
Yeah, really, they should be in poetry anthologies as opposed to anthologies of women's poetry, I suppose, is what we would say to finish up. But listen, yes, congratulations to both of you, both on the essays and on the publication itself. Yeah. It's called Look, It's a Woman Writer, which I think is a super title, and suitably enough, edited by Eilish Ngwivna, who's been speaking with us this evening, Maya Cannon, one of the contributors, suitably enough, it is published by Arlen House. And so to our album reviews on this Friday evening. First up will be songwriter, composer and singer Laura Mvula, winner of an Ivor Novello Award in 2019 and her first two albums nominated for Mercury Awards. Hugely successful. Is there pressure on her third album, which arrives today and is called Pink Noise? Then we'll speak about Bobby Gillespie, best known as the frontman of Primal Scream, who teams up with Jenny Beth, French musician, singer, songwriter, producer, presenter and actress, best known as the front woman of the English band Savages. Their new collaboration is called Utopian Ashes. And finally, Irish singer-songwriter Brendan Tallon generated much acclaim as the leader of the Irish band Revelino. But we're speaking tonight about the new album that he's given us, which is called Love in These Times. We'll start with Laura Mvula's third album called Pink Noises, as I said, or Pink Noise, sorry, and this is a track called Magical. Don't let go of the magic. This is everything worth fighting for. More than you ever could imagine. I can see you through that open door. That's a track called Magical from Pink Noise and Laura Mvula's new album. It's difficult to under-express, if that's even a word, to the success that Laura Mvula has had in a relatively short period of time, Nadine.
Yeah, I mean, this is her third album and she's already had what amounts to a very dramatic career in music. She was signed for a 5-album deal by Sony and then unceremoniously dropped in 2017. Bear in mind, she'd already been nominated for a Mercury Prize for one of her albums, but the second album didn't do it commercially and she got an email, a 7-sentence email, which she talked about on Twitter, and then had to move forward in an incredibly difficult position because she's a high-profile musician who would appear on Graham Norton, who's had her struggles, which she's been very open about around her mental health and other areas, and is now coming back 5 years on from that second album with this new record that kind of has to make it for her, because she is in a precarious position.
I didn't say that it's Nadine O'Regan and Eamon Sweeney. I don't think that are our reviewers this evening. So we just heard from Nadine there. Let's go to you, Eamon. Nadine saying they're talking about a new record. Is it the same Laura Mvula? Not that there was anything wrong in my mind anyway with the previous Laura Mvula, the one that we knew from the first two albums. Is there anything new in what she's doing in terms of the sound or the soundscape that she's presenting to us?
Well, the sound, as we just heard from a bit of Magical, is so 80s, unbelievably 80s. And, you know, when she started, that early kind of breakthrough hit Green Garden was kind of introducing a very innovative, soulful kind of sound, and with her vocal and her unique vision to the fore, where this, her voice is processed a lot, and it does sound like she's having fun. It's certainly a departure.
There's a big butt waiting to come out of your mouth, I think, Eamon.
Yeah, a big butt, as in like, it's great to be inspired by the 80s, but this sounds like it's completely enthralled to it. I don't get any sense that I'm hearing a record from 2021 here.
Because one of the things that I remember particularly about the first album, I think, was these rhythms, these cross rhythms and very interesting rhythms that came, I think, probably from gospel music and from her own background, her own ethnic background, her ethnicity. That were very interesting to hear and very interesting to listen to. Has she moved on from that, Nadine, into this more kind of 80s soulful sound?
Yeah, I mean, listening to this record, it's got, you know, shoulder pads on practically. I mean, it's carrying a boombox and standing outside the window, you know, waiting for the girl to come down. It is so 80s, could not be any more so. And look, I actually love the 80s. I love the synths. I love the soundscapes. I love the layering that she achieves. And her vocal is, you know, very charismatic, quite remarkable. She can go from great stridency to great softness. She is a captivating artist. Is it really her? Is it totally sincere? That's probably where I have an element of a question mark. Because if you look through the old interviews, she talks about being raised on a diet of Nina Simone, Jill Scott, Miles Davis and John Coltrane. And you think about that and you kind of think, well, she, as I was saying, is in kind of a tough position at the moment. And if you were going to go towards a more commercial vision, think about an artist like, say, Dua Lipa, who's folded in 80s textures very successfully into her record recently. And perhaps there's an element of needing to move towards that kind of market.
All right. Well, let's listen to another track, What Matters, which also features Simon Neill. Certainly, there's not enough hair in studio to be playing a track like that. That's Laura Mvula, What Matters, featuring Simon Neill. Eamon, I'm guessing that kind of proves your point that it's totally steeped in the 80s.
Oh.
Is that a big problem for you on this album?
It is, because of the kind of 80s, the naff 80s that it's steeped in. Like Simon Neill there, that, you know, listeners
Biffy
would know.
Cairo.
Biffy Cairo. And he sounds like Biddy Ocean there. Maybe my 80s would be more Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, Soft Cell, New Order, Erasure, and so on. You know, that's what I think, you know, it's synth pop where the synth doesn't take over. The synth is just constantly in your face. Like the intro there to that tune of What Matters is going like, oh God, what weird nightclub am I trapped in? And Nadine mentioned shoulder pads. They're like constantly... It evokes those kind of that kind of imagery,
which doesn't sound good to me when it comes to counting up your stars, Eamon.
I'll go two.
You're going two, and you think that's generous. What are you saying, Nadine?
I'm a huge fan of the 80s. This is a bit over the top for me. I think the 80s is controlling her rather than the other way around. But I still think there are some fantastic songs on the record, like Got Me or Church Girl. So on that basis, I'm going to give it 3.5. I'll definitely be playing those again.
All right. Okay. So difference of opinion there, I think, on Laura Mvula and Pink Noise. Let's move on to Bobby Gillespie and Jenny Beth. They've an album called Utopian Ashes. This is how it opens. Chase It Down, the opening track on that album, Utopian Ashes, from Bobby Gillespie and Jenny Beth. Eamon, for people who maybe won't be familiar with the careers of these two artists separately, is it an obvious partnership? Is it quite a curious partnership? Is it a totally unexpected partnership?
I wouldn't say it's curious, but not totally unexpected. I suppose, you know, Savages and Primal Scream would be broadly, you know, alternative rock bands from different eras, though. So I suppose that's what makes it a kind of a little bit unexpected. And they kind of are channeling, I suppose, Lee Hazelwood, Nancy Sinatra, Emmylou Harris, Tammy Wynette and George Jones. Those kind of country soul duets with lots of strings and lots of drama. And this is about a kind of a fictional marriage that is breaking up with Bobby and Jenny playing, singing those roles.
I said to you as we were listening, and I said, first track, when I put it on first today, I was thinking, that sounds very like Oasis. To which you responded,
well, the lyrics are way better.
You also said, and they're sincere.
And they're sincere. Not that Liam Gallagher isn't sincere, but there's a blunt force weapon vibe off his vocal that means that I think they succeed very well when they're doing a certain type of indie rock song, but not maybe so well when Noel Gallagher uses, as has sometimes been his wont, lyrics from old nursery rhymes and that kind of thing. In this, I think it's a very kind of delicate confection with a lot of sincerity there's a whole theme around this album of a couple who've broken apart, and Bobby Gillespie and Jenny Beth are singing to each other. And the funny thing about this is a lot of it doesn't feel particularly new. You know, it can actually feel borderline derivative at points. But if you listen to it a few times, it begins to seep in. The layers of orchestration are very lovely and they sound very comfortable in that sort of area of almost country indie at certain points. And that's something that Primal Scream have experimented a small bit with on older albums. And actually, I think it suited them quite well. And I liked this, I have to say.
Yeah. I think that country aspect is there for sure in a couple of tracks. Let's have a listen to something a bit further down the playlist. This is Remember We Were Lovers, which kind of gets into this whole idea of the concept of the breakup, the marriage falling apart. Remember We Were Lovers from Bobby Gillespie and Jenny Beth, from Utopian Ashes. Yeah, there's a real sense of the almost a country duet in that one, Eamon.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the album's strongest tracks. And it's a real duet. If I have any criticism of, sometimes I think there's a bit too much Bobby and not enough Jenny Beth. Like one track opens with this kind of confessional Bobby Gillespie talking about the barren years of his life and so on.
That's the one with the bit of spoken word at the top of it.
Spoken word, exactly.
It's You Can Trust Me Now, I think.
Yes, You Can Trust Me Now, exactly.
Yeah, and there's one a track called English Town, which kind of jars a lot with the rest of the album because it just kind of seems to be about a theme that Primal Scream would tap into a lot about kind of the boredom and alienation of small town England. It's a bit uneven, but overall, you know, very, very pleasant. Some wonderful, wonderful moments.
Well, pleasant isn't a very difficult word to be hearing the odd time.
Comforting. Okay. Soothing. Yeah.
So how many stars does pleasant get, Eamon?
3.5.
3.5. And how many stars does comforting get, Nadine?
Honestly, I'm going to be generous and say 3.5. It is lovely.
All right. You both had a different Friday from me, clearly. I was neither comforting nor, what was the other word?
Comforted, soothed.
Or pleasant word. I was in a different place. However, that's not important. Let us move on to Brendan Tallon and our third album this evening, an album that is called Love in These Times. Here's a track called American Strings. American Strings from Brendan Tallon and Love in These Times. Give me a little bit of the previous projects of Brendan Tallon before we find out why he went off to California to write the songs for this album, Nadine.
Yeah, you're hearing the Beach Boys as well.
All
are
the
you?
Time, yeah.
Well, Revelino would be the big one. And actually, Dublin's Revelino, they reissued their debut album last year and they actually hit the top of the indie vinyl charts in doing so, which was a lovely triumph for them. And he's also been involved going back years with other groups, Coltranes and Saturday Captains. And he's somebody who clearly loves music. Every single sort of whisper on this record has been thoroughly vetted before being allowed out of the studio. This is a record made with immense love and seemingly, I think, over a great deal of time. All of the tracks were written, arranged, produced and played by Talon in his home studio. And there's such sophistication in the layering. I mean, I'm hearing bands like the Beatles, artists like Elliot Smith, and then, of course, we mentioned the Beach Boys. But at the same time, it's kind of an homage to more than it is.
Yeah, I mean, because we definitely, I heard the Beach Boys across several of the tracks on this album. Mm-hmm. But does Brendan Talon manage to move that away from being just, you know, a pastiche or derivative into something else?
Oh, I definitely think so. Like, this essentially, like, and it's a lovely title for the times, loving these times.
It's a beautiful title, actually. It is, for sure, yeah. And
the thread for him is about that love is something not to give up on. And for him, that includes music. And this is, you know, kind of from a guy who's done so many different projects over the years, but just comes back to the compulsion of making this beautifully crafted music. Yes, there is elements of all those kind of people that have met. I think Love Forever Changes would be one I would throw in there. Some tracks, I think there's a nod towards Mark Bolan, but, you know, not this kind of glam rock with feather boas and kind of mascara and so on, but kind of like just the sonics of it and the kind of the aesthetic of the sound.
I want to get another little sample of it before we finish up. So let's have a listen to the opening section of a track called Last of the Russian Dolls.
You couldn't give up the kindness of honesty drops like a coin in a cup. Try to hide feelings behind a disguise, and you got caught in a lie.
Yeah, I just wanted to hear that guitar playing again, and it's even crisper when we hear it on the big speakers in here. Did this album work for you? I think it did, Nadine. And what are you saying, stars wise?
It did. Stars wise, I'm going to go 3.5, and I would have put it a tiny bit higher, except for I think it did get a little bit samey towards the end, but certainly an album to return to.
All right. What are you saying, Eamon?
I would go a very strong 4.5. I think it's a really, really good piece of work. Well worth checking out.
Perilously close to the 5 there, Eamon. Eamon Sweeney and Nadine O'Regan, our reviewers this evening, speaking to us about Brendan Talon's Loving These Times, Bobby Gillespie and Jenny Betts, Utopian Ashes, and Pink Noise from Laura and Vulin. That's our lot for this Friday night and for this week here in Arena. Paula Shields was the researcher this evening. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound supervision, and tonight's programme was produced by Kay Shee. Talk to you Monday, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio.